Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Our first segment, a deep dive into the thyroid gland. So I just want to start by saying on the subject of the thyroid gland that when you talk about any gland in the human body, you sort of have to decide if you're going to start with the brain or with the gland, because it's one big loop. I wanted to remind you, we started on this thyroid gland talk last week, and this is a continuation, but I'm going to recap the first part just to give context to those who weren't listening to the program last week. So diseases of the thyroid can be classified as hyper, too much activity of the gland, or hypo, not enough activity of the gland. And there are lots of causes of both. Autoimmune disease, oddly enough, can do either one. And in fact, it gets very confusing. There is an autoimmune disease called Graves, where you make an antibody that actually mimics thyroid-stimulating hormone and stimulates the thyroid uncontrollably. Essentially, your immune system steals control of the thyroid from your brain. Not good. The second type of autoimmune disease is Hashimoto's, and Hashimoto's eventually destroys the thyroid and causes hypothyroidism. But because it's an immune attack, it's intermittent. And so just like people with lupus or rheumatoid arthritis will tell you, they have flares and then they have remissions. Well, during the flares of Hashimoto's in the early stages, people may actually become hypothyroid. And then during the remissions, the pituitary gland has sent out such a large, loud signal saying, make more thyroid. When the thyroid finally wakes up, it makes too much until the pituitary readjusts itself. So you can have a series of feeling too hot all the time, sweaty, losing weight, having diarrhea, and then going into feeling cold all the time, having constipation, and gaining weight. So it can be extraordinarily difficult in the early stages to know exactly what's going on. Another one that'll give you a biphasic response is viral infection of the thyroid. When the virus first inflames the thyroid, it's called viral thyroiditis, your thyroid dumps all of its stored thyroid hormone and people become hyperthyroid. Then a month later, the thyroid is depleted of thyroid hormone from its storage tanks are dry, and the person is hypothyroid. Many people at that point are misdiagnosed as having Hashimoto's and are told, well, you've got low thyroid, you're going to have to take pills for the rest of your life. And, you know, there are probably people within the sound of my voice that that happened to, and it ain't necessarily so, but the only way you'll find out is to taper your thyroid slowly and monitor that TSH. Children, do not try this at home. You need to be under the guidance of a doctor. Unfortunately, antibody testing will not differentiate because after several years, the Hashimoto's antibodies to thyroid peroxidase, or TPO, disappear, and you can't tell what happened. And of course, there's also surgical. People who've had part or all of their thyroid removed for cancer, who've had thyroid irradiation for Graves' disease, or who've had surgical treatment of a toxic nodule. What's that? Well, that's a little part of the thyroid gland that decides to go off on its own and make lots of hormone, and again, is ignoring the signals from the brain. So we're going to start with talking about the gland. And the gland itself is sort of an interesting shape. It's kind of a dumbbell-shaped organ in the neck, and it's sort of sitting there right under your aptly named thyroid cartilage. If you feel the part that moves up and down when you swallow and you go below that, you may be able to feel your thyroid. Often in a normal thyroid, it's kind of hiding below the collarbone, and you have to get your fingers down there and give the person some water when we have the situation. So we want to feel the thyroid. We want to check for lumps or bumps. That's often how thyroid cancer is picked up, is on a routine physical. Another reason why routine physicals are, as far as I'm concerned, not a thing of the past that needs to be ignored, because none of the, well, I won't say none, but, you know, many of the AIs have difficulty performing a physical, and they're really trying to automate medicine to a degree that is, well, let's just say foolish, in my opinion. Now, the thyroid is composed of a series of hollow balls, rather like an embryo, and the walls of the ball are made up of what are called follicular cells. The follicular cells are cells that do the hard work of creating these complex structures. So just like many cells, they have a glandular output. But they also produce something called colloid, which is a gel-like substance that fills the center of the ball. And some very, very interesting things are going on in the colloid, probably rather more regulated than we think. Now, also hanging around in that gland, you have parafollicular cells, and no one quite knows what they do, but I think they probably do something very important. I just haven't found anything that explains it to me. So let's move into a single cell. Now we're going to look at that wall. And on the outside of the wall is blood. And in that blood is thyroid-stimulating hormone. More about that later. And a receptor, we all know about receptors now, that the thyroid-stimulating hormone fits into it. It causes a change in the shape of the part that's inside the cell, and that change sets off a series of chain reactions, goes to the nucleus of the cell, builds up some messenger RNA, sends it back out, and we start doing protein synthesis. And we make two things. We make some enzymes that are going to be really important for getting that thyroid hormone out into the body, and we make a substance called thyroglobulin. And thyroglobulin is the backbone for the production process. That gets spit in to the colloid. And it's in the colloid that we make the thyroid hormone itself. It's sort of like pop beads. You create the thyroid hormone, you attach it to the protein, and then that protein and the thyroid hormone backbone gets iodine added to it. So basically, thyroglobulin plus iodine equals thyroid hormone, that little fishbone backbone, and you've got the beginnings of your molecule. Well, then it gets sucked back into the cell, and one of those enzymes I talked about earlier is protease, and it is going to basically chop the thyroid hormone off and send it out into the bloodstream. What's important in this synthesis process? Well, you need some minerals. You need chromium, zinc, and selenium. Those need to be part of a diet. If you're deficient in any of those important cofactors, you'll have trouble either getting the glucose into the cell, that's where the zinc and chromium come in, or getting the thyroid hormone to work, the hormone that to be made, I should say. And that happens with something called deiodinase. This deiodinase is really interesting, and it turns out to be extremely important genetically. There are three groups, and it depends on what tissue we're talking about. If you have a mutation in one of your deiodinases, you might have a problem making your active thyroid hormone. Let me take a moment and define this storage thyroid hormone, or T4, and active thyroid hormone, or T3. So I think you've got the basic context here. There's these two hormones. What's the diff? Well, about 90% of what you make in the thyroid gland and release into your bloodstream is actually the inactive storage form of thyroid. And about 10% is pre-activated. And it's the pre-activated T3. It's too dangerous to dump that all into the bloodstream. You'd be going from 60 to zero and then back again to 60. Wouldn't be good for your heart, your brain, or basically anything else. So as I said, you've got three deiodinases, 1, 2, and 3. They pretty much are the same. They do the same thing. But there's a special one, deiodinase 3, that's present only in the brain, the placenta, the uterus, and fetal tissue. And a mutation in that can have substantial effects on whether or not one can have a viable pregnancy. So now we're going to take a step backwards. We've been focused at the molecular level. Actually, before I leave the molecular level, let me just say T4, it's called 4 because it's tyrosine, an amino acid, and it's got 4 iodines stuck onto it. That's it. Tyrosine, an amino acid, plus 4 iodines, and you pretty much got your hormone. It's not a steroid hormone. Now, because you've got 4, it's got a mirror image, right? It doesn't have a sidedness. Hold up your hand and imagine one of those handprint keys that you see sometimes in the movies. I think they actually exist, where you put your palm print down and, you know, your thumb is on one side of your hand. If you, your palm, that's your right hand. If you tried to put your hand, your left hand in the device that was looking for a thumb, it wouldn't work. If you tried to turn your back of your hand over, the device would see that there was no fingerprints and palm prints, and it wouldn't unlock the door. There's essentially a left-handed thyroid. That's the reverse T3. And because it's the mirror image, it'll fit in the receptor, but it won't actually activate it. We have a drug called tamoxifen. It's exactly the same. It fits into the estrogen receptor, but it doesn't activate it. It's a blocker. The drug naloxone, it fits into the opiate receptor, but it doesn't activate it. So it reverses opiate overdose. So now you're starting to see that handedness of these molecules, as we've talked about before, is really important. Now let's zoom out. All right. We've zoomed out quite a lot, and now we're looking at the whole system. So it all starts at the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is like the monitoring station. It's tasting your blood, it's noting your temperature, it's looking at your glucose, it's checking all the levels, the tire pressure, all of the fluid levels in your body. It's also monitoring for toxins, and if it senses a toxin, the hypothalamus is going to make you vomit because you've just eaten something you shouldn't have, and if it makes you throw up soon enough, as soon as it starts absorbing into the bloodstream, maybe you won't die. So it does a lot, our hypothalamus. But one of the things it does is it has a private little back channel to the pituitary, and it sends hormones into the pituitary. There's a thyroid-releasing hormone. That's going to, guess what, stimulate the thyroid system. There's a follicular stimulating hormone. Guess what that does? Well, it makes eggs and sperm. There's a luteinizing hormone. There's ACTH, which is adrenal cortical releasing hormone, effectively. So that goes to the adrenals. You're getting the gist here, right? The hypothalamus controls an awful lot. We won't get into the control of the pancreas. The pancreas is a more autonomous organ, although it does have neurologic control from the brain. We're not going to go there for today. But that TSH, that goes to the pituitary. And because it's a private back channel blood system, we can't measure it in the blood. We'd have to stick a needle into the artery in the brain. Not usually done. The pituitary responds, if it's not damaged, doesn't have a tumor in it, or hasn't had radiation or a stroke, it'll make thyroid stimulating hormone. And this always trips people up, okay? The higher the thyroid stimulating hormone, the lower the blood levels of thyroid are going to be. Because the hypothalamus has said, oh, not enough thyroid. Pituitary, tell your guy to make more thyroid. So the TSH is high when the thyroid hormone is low. On the opposite, if I give someone, let's say I give someone T4, okay? I'm giving them Synthroid. I'm giving them levothyroxine. Well, that's the storage form. So it takes a while to be activated. But the hypothalamus is measuring T4. So it's going to look at T4 levels. It's going to say, okay, that looks good. No problem. Keep sending that same signal. The pituitary says, okay, good. So by looking at the TSH, we can pretty much figure out if we are giving people enough artificial or natural T4. But as I said, the T4 has to be activated. And if your person has, and there are some of the challenges I'll talk about, there are a lot of things that will actually interfere with the production of the active thyroid hormone. The active thyroid hormone, T3, goes into your cells, activates a nuclear modulator, something that goes into the nucleus and modifies the DNA and turns on a whole suite of hormones related to metabolism and energy generation. So it revs up your metabolism so that you can make more ATP. And by making more ATP, you have more energy and you can do things like build muscle or walk around the block or digest your food or, and this is interesting, make hormones. So people with low thyroid, it tends to interfere with the production of all the body's hormones because everything is connected in this great spider web of influences. So what are some of the things that we can do? Well, we can jump over the activation step and give people T3. That's called Cytomel or leothreonine, and those are available as pharmaceuticals. We can give a natural thyroid extract like Armour Thyroid or Nature Thyroid, and these are derived from animals, and they are variously 10% T3 to 20% D3, depending upon various factors, but the animals have a different ratio than humans. And if a person takes that, they're getting some pre-made T3, but they're also getting some storage T4 that their body can convert. So it acts to smooth the up and downs. So like I said, you aren't swerving from 0 to 60 and back again all the time, which is very hard on the body. So now we get into what interferes with this process of inactivating T4. And why would the body have that? Why would we have reverse T3? What good is it? I first heard about this in medical school, and it was thought to be very rare, and it was called euthyroid sick syndrome. Euthyroid is Latin for the thyroid's okay. How do we know the thyroid's okay? Well, we know it's okay because the TSH levels are normal. Oh, okay. Well, what's happening? Well, even though the TSH levels are normal, there isn't enough active T3 in the system, and so the metabolism shuts down. When would this happen? When you're sick, when you're in the ICU. Remember all those people in the ICU for 4 weeks, you know, fighting off a disease with feeding tubes and on ventilators? Well, a lot of them probably have euthyroid sick syndrome, and that may be a significant chunk of the long COVID people. I don't know for sure, but I do know that they aren't probably being checked for it because it's just not on the event horizon of traditionally, or I should say conventionally trained physicians, which is sad because one of the other things that does this is stress of all kinds, particularly if a person's been chronically stressed for a long time, been doing a lot of caffeine, not been getting enough sleep. You know what'll happen? They'll kind of crash. We call that chronic fatigue syndrome. Some of those, they've stopped really making cortisol. And that they had high cortisol levels for so long that they've kind of burnt out the body's ability. The body said, oh, well, I shouldn't be making T3. I'll just make reverse T3 instead. And so those people too, some of them. And again, it's a syndrome, which means there's multiple diseases causing the same symptoms. So you just can't tell. What do I recommend here? Well, first of all, if you've just been diagnosed as hypothyroidism and your symptoms occurred recently, make the doctor check for TPO antibodies. You may not have permanent hypothyroidism. You could have a viral inflammation that then went to a depletion. Think about having, if you know that you've been burning the candle at both ends, well, stop, for one thing, and start taking care of yourself and get your thyroid hormone checked. But recognize that because the doctors aren't checking for T3, half the time they're going to tell you, you're fine, your thyroid's fine, and it may not be. So good luck requesting that they check a T3 and a reverse T3. The healthy ratio of that, in my experience, the books all say 10 to 1. I've been practicing in Silicon Valley. Let's call it 7 to 1 and above. And if people are competitive athletes or they are just, you know, hitting the computer and pounding whatever for 12 to 14 hours a day and not getting adequate rest, you're probably going to find something wrong. And that might be the first place to go. Iodine, maybe some selenium, a little more sleep. Sometimes the simple things are best, and you can get people back without resorting to pharmaceuticals. Well, I think that that's enough on the thyroid, but I welcome your questions, should you have any. And I think I'll take just a moment to answer one or two of our emails. So, let's start with one from Kathy in Pacific Grove. Hi, Dr. Dawn. This is about antibiotics and microbiome. Thanks for your podcast. I've been a listener for years. My adult son has a tooth infection that is quite extensive. The doctor has prescribed penicillin. It's now been 2 to 3 weeks on penicillin, and he is seeing an oral surgeon next week, but I'm really concerned about the infection, but also being on penicillin for so long. I know you've recommended probiotics while taking antibiotics. Can you remind me of your recommended protocol? He's eating kefir and kimchi, but I don't think it's enough. Well, the first thing I want to say, Kathy, is at least it's not clindamycin. Penicillin is much easier to come back from than clindamycin. One microbiologist that works for one of these alternative laboratories that I had lunch with once a couple of years ago told me that he can look at the DNA profile of someone's gut and tell if they've ever had clindamycin. I also recently saw a patient who I think managed to absorb clindamycin across her skin and mess up her microbiome. She was using large amounts for what she took to be a bacterial skin condition, but I'm thinking now, maybe that's a factor in her current issues. The point is, clindamycin is not a benign drug. It's very bad for the microbiome, which may be why it's the antibiotic with the highest association with an overgrowth of a toxin-producing relative of tetanus called Clostridium difficile. Now, a couple of questions that you can't answer because this is an email, but to think about, does your son have an appendix? Because if you've got an appendix, you have a reservoir, a seed bank, so to speak, of your innate microbiome. So that's an important consideration when it comes to giving probiotics. The second question that I have about it is, was he breastfed? And do you have IBS? If you don't, that is to say irritable bowel syndrome in any of its manifestations, if you don't, then your little guy, when he was a little guy, got a good microbiome from you. And hopefully he did. Also, does he have IBS? Because unfortunately, no matter what you get from mom through breast milk or through the vagina, if you're born vaginally, you can kill it with enough antibiotics in early childhood. So let's assume, for the sake of argument, that he's starting out pretty well. My probiotic protocol is based on preventing diarrhea, and it's got a pretty good clinical track record. And that protocol is a mix of 4 or 5 at least different species, combining at least 1 lactobacillus and 1 bifidobacterium. And a lot of times there's other stuff in there. And I typically have people take about 50, that's 50 billion, twice a day for the duration of antibiotics plus 1 week. And then maybe drop to half that dose if they still experienced any GI upset or change in their bowel movements during the therapy. Now, in traveler's diarrhea, if someone is traveling, I'll have them take up to 200 billion organisms every time they have a loose stool. And this level of bacteria shuts down traveler's diarrhea. It just kind of papers it over, and you still may have microbiome work to do. But if you happen to be hiking in Tibet and antibiotic allergic, having something that shuts down the diarrhea is very useful. A recent study came out showing that using probiotics with antibiotics may delay recovery of the microbiome. First of all, I'm not entirely sure that isn't a lab artifact. And secondly, I'm not actually sure I care. And that's because of this toxin-producing relative of tetanus I mentioned, the Clostridium difficile. There is a yeast, a beneficial yeast called Saccharomyces boulardii, that has in scientific trials, and there are quite a few of them, it even, in fact, is on some hospital formularies. That's how good the data is. The S. boulardii, and also the marketing, I might add, of the particular company that makes the pharmaceutical version, because they do a lot of marketing. But they managed to get it on the hospital formulary, so go them. S. boulardii, and the dose there is about 25 billion organisms a day. Sometimes you'll see it as milligrams, and that's usually about 500 to 1,000 milligrams. This can also be useful to squeeze out candida-type yeast infections, although I haven't seen any studies looking at it in some of the really nasty candidas that are starting to show up. I think we covered this a few years ago, but there's a new candida called Candida aureus on the horizon. And this one will grow inside at body temperature. Most candida can't handle 97.8 or whatever the average body temperature is officially anymore. It can't handle that temp. This one can. Maybe that's an effect of global warming, but it's a bad news because eradicating candida, if it's growing inside the body instead of just colonizing the gut, can require very high doses of toxic agents that, you know, no one wants to go there. So think of it as weeds in the garden. Interestingly, even if you heat kill the probiotics, they work. It's kind of like using redwood mulch. It's dead redwood, but it blocks somebody else getting in there and growing, and that's kind of what you need. Other issues with high-dose probiotics, like the one I mentioned in my protocol, you need to screen for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. This is a condition where the person probably doesn't make enough stomach acid, or they've had, say, gastric bypass surgery. In situations like this, the bacteria in the small intestine, the counts go up 10 or even 100-fold compared to what they normally should be. Individuals with this condition are literally competing with bacteria for carbohydrates. So when they eat starch, sugar, anything with a fermentable fructooligosaccharide, which is a lot of things, they will bloat and have really severe gas pain. And so that's one of those categories of irritable bowel syndrome. Not all IBS can be cured with antibiotics. And in fact, I don't recommend taking gastroenterologist prescribed antibiotics for your SIBO because you will breed resistance and it will come back because you haven't gotten rid of the enabling conditions. Just like I have to continually kill the mold in the ceiling of my bathroom where I take my shower every day. You know, it's warm, it's moist. The fungi are very happy. I'm never going to keep them from growing until I can dry out that space permanently. And I don't want to use the chemicals it would take to do that. Another thing you need to do, you've said that he was on kefir and kimchi. It wouldn't hurt to include more prebiotic fiber. You could add inulin powder, I-N-U-L-I-N, to a shake. Or you could simply eat a couple of root vegetables a day, alternating between them. Apples are also a decent source. The best root source is actually Jerusalem artichokes, sometimes called sunchokes locally. They're pretty much pure inulin, and these are not fibers that our bodies can digest. So as a result, they're there for the bacteria. But again, if you've got SIBO, you will bloat with this. So let's go now to a new discussion, a second email. Sandy from Massachusetts writes, long-term COVID effects. Listening to your latest podcast, you were asking for people who have long-term effects from COVID. A year ago, I developed a respiratory illness that lasted over 6 weeks. It was unlike anything I've ever had, with gooey, thick mucus in my lower lungs. By the time I was able to be tested, I was 4 weeks into my illness. The one test was negative at that time. That test was in April. I was an active 74-year-old, yoga, swimming 3 to 4 miles a week, and hiking 1 or 2 days a week. Since then, I've had continuous daily thick mucus and a considerable lack of energy. I still do my activities, and it seems to loosen the mucus, but my energy level is not anywhere to where it was. I'd be interested in participating in your study if you deem it to be appropriate. Well, Sandy, first of all, I'd have to say that because you are out of state, I wouldn't be able to enroll you in my study, but I can give you some suggestions. I have some comments first, though. So the nasal tests that you had in April, there were lots of false negatives on those early nasal tests. I saw a few myself. It was an unpleasant test to have. The negatives that I saw that I thought were probably false negatives were people who did not experience distress during testing. If you didn't find that really unpleasant, you probably didn't get a good specimen. And that is unfortunately true. That was why self-testing back in those days was, I think, also very problematic, because it's hard to shove that thing back far enough and get to the very back of the nasopharynx, lots of nerve endings back there. And I don't think that most people who weren't desperate medical personnel were willing to put themselves through it. One could ask, well, could I get an antibody test? And unfortunately, we now know that while antibodies do hang around in the blood for a while, they fade. And so 6 months out, probably an antibody test is not definitive, especially if it's negative. You didn't mention whether you've been vaccinated, but that might actually be an indirect way of figuring it out. I've mainly been using my protocol, which I'll discuss in a moment, in people who got a prolonged malaise after vaccination. They almost got an over-inflammatory reaction. Many of these people were older. None of them had autoimmune disease, but they had aches, pains, flu-like symptoms, and blah, lasting, in one case, 3 weeks after their vaccination. And that just seemed way too far. And it seemed like, from their symptoms, that they had inflammation. So I used a non-specific anti-inflammatory agent that is used widely in alternative circles in multiple sclerosis. But I'm very comfortable with using this agent because there's a pharmaceutical, and the basic dose of that pharmaceutical is 10 times, that's right, 10 times the upper dose that I ever give to anyone. The term for this is low-dose naltrexone. Now, naltrexone is FDA approved at 50 milligrams for the management of alcoholism, support of continuation of sobriety in alcoholism. And it works by blocking the opiate and dopamine receptors in the brain so that alcohol just isn't as rewarding as it should be. At lower doses, like say 3 to 4 milligrams, it seems to have only an effect on the circulating white blood cells and the inflammatory cells that are produced in a case of sort of chronic fatigue or chronic inflammatory response syndrome, which I really think the long COVID is in many people. Like I was saying earlier in the talk, people who were very sick, which you weren't, you had a bad chest infection, but you didn't end up in the ICU. People who spent time in the ICU, either on a ventilator or ECMO or, you know, really struggling, they should be checked for elevated levels of reverse T3. But that's just my opinion. Now, getting back to you, I certainly hope you have had vaccination. And a question to ask yourself is, how much of a reaction did you have after your first shot, assuming you were on a 2-shot regimen? And if you had a pretty exaggerated reaction, and I guess, how do you know what's exaggerated? Well, if I give a tetanus shot to someone who still has a lot of antibody to tetanus, they will have a lot of pain in that arm, but they won't get pain in their other joints. The arm may not even want to move the arm for a day or two. It may even swell, but their legs are fine. If you get the COVID shot, your first one, and you get global body aches that last for more than 48 hours, you have to consider that you may have actually had COVID. There's no way to prove or disprove it. And with respect to your symptoms, I think I'm glad that activity loosens the mucus. I think that you should get your thyroid checked. And I would say your reverse T3, your total T3, and your TSH and your free T4. But don't let them do a free T3 on you, because you need that reverse T3, and it's much easier to do the ratio of 10 to 1 than it is to do the calculation on the free T3. This, again, is my opinion. The other thing, that if there is a functional medicine doctor, let's see, you're somewhere in Massachusetts. Well, Massachusetts is not all that big a state. There are plenty of functional medicine doctors there. You could go to the Institute for Functional Medicine and functionalmedicine.org, use their Find a Doctor, find yourself a certified functional medicine doctor, and go talk to them about maybe a short trial of low-dose naltrexone. But I do want to emphasize, you do not fit the profile of the people I've been using it in. And I do think you need to be checked for other infections. I do think that you need pulmonary function tests. You may have triggered with this infection a chronic bronchitis, which is an inflammatory condition that doesn't always go away. And it's important that other things like, you know, don't be scared, but, you know, you need to have tuberculosis ruled out. You need to have other illnesses checked, and you need a workup. So I hope that has been helpful. But this is one of those situations where at 74, I think, you know, letting the guys in conventional medicine give you the once over is an excellent idea. And thank God for Medicare, you probably won't be out a pretty penny to get that evaluation. That is ifm.org, not functionalmedicine.org. Please excuse the error. And let's move on to a functional medicine approach to uterine fibroids. Fibroids are benign tumors of the uterus, and the numbers of women who have at least a small fibroid in their body is actually fairly staggering. 60% of reproductive-aged women at any given moment have fibroids if you check. Some of them are quite small, many of them are asymptomatic, and the lifetime risk of developing the disease is about 80% because of some women develop them and then when they go through menopause, they disappear. That's actually fairly common. But the age that you're at the greatest risk, and there's some other conditions as well that I will talk about in a moment, the age of greatest risk is at 40 to 54 years. And what's that? Well, that's the age of perimenopause. So what do fibroids do? Well, when they are symptomatic, you typically have heavy or prolonged menstrual bleeding, and you can bleed at odd times. Bleeding can be triggered by activity, either sexual or strenuous physical activity, and as a result, anemia. There's also infertility or frequent pregnancy loss. Sometimes women keep having miscarriages, and when you remove the fibroids, they stop having miscarriages. And pelvic pain, of course, is not surprising at all, because this is a big lump in a muscle. And when you have a big lump in a muscle, when you use it, it hurts. It turns out that while surgery is often used, lifestyle interventions can do a great deal. First of all, they can protect you from fibroids if they run in your family. And second of all, if you have any of the risk factors, particularly obesity, they should be considered a first-line treatment. So we're going to start with talking about abdominal fat. Abdominal fat, that is to say belly fat, not butt fat, contains a hormone that helps make estrogen. In fact, belly fat will take the output of your pituitary glands and turn it into a stronger, more powerful form of estrogen. If you have more fat, you're going to make more estrogen, and fibroids are driven by high levels of estrogen. If you take that fibroid out, take out a little of the normal uterine muscle, in next to it, there'll be higher levels of estrogen in the fibroid. It concentrates there. It's a couple of symptoms of high estrogen levels: breast tenderness in the first half of the menstrual cycle especially, and heavy periods. Women who have these things are most at risk. And also a clue is women who are intolerant of oral contraceptive pills. The other thing that visceral adipose tissue does is it increases inflammation, and it also increases insulin. So it sets you up to be at higher risk for diabetes. And those are obviously things that we need to avoid. Now, there was a small study done a few years ago. They found that premenopausal women who had high levels of fruit and vegetable intake had a greatly decreased risk of fibroids. And of course, the higher your BMI, the greater your risk. We've already talked about that. People who have a waist to butt measurement, and the way you do that is halfway between your ribs and your hip bone is considered your natural waistline. And then the widest part around the lower abdomen and hip area is considered your butt measurement. That measurement, in a woman, your waist should be at least 4/5 of your hips. So that's 0.8 or 80%. If your waist is the same as your hips or bigger than your hips, then you have, by definition, a risk for fibroids. A third issue is how much effectiveness there is in the biotransformation or estrogen clearance system. We've talked about detoxification many, many times on this program. And your diet also influences the detoxification pathway. There's a genetic link. There is a enzyme made by the body called COMT, which stands for catechol-O-methyltransferase. But COMT is very important to help your body get rid of estrogen. And if you don't get rid of estrogen properly, it'll accumulate in those fibroids and cause them to grow. In terms of what we want to advise for people, it rather depends on our priority. If a person is just overweight and doesn't have high insulin levels, then we probably want to recommend intermittent fasting or a ketogenic diet. This is very good for fibroids, and also high-intensity interval training if the person's joints will take it. This is where you exercise at maximal intensity for 30 seconds or 60 seconds, and then just kind of rest or walk in place for a minute or two, and then repeat. These lead to a direct decrease of the amount of estrogen in the body, because as you build muscle, you actually reduce the estrogen output. And in fact, women whose fat-to-muscle ratio is very low, like gymnasts or ballerinas, often have trouble even producing enough estrogen to grow an egg or have a period. The muscle-building strategy is very good for people who are just overweight. But if a person has elevated insulin levels at any weight, we want to use a keto diet or a cardiometabolic diet. That means a very low starch diet, very low sugar, very low starch. And the intermittent fasting can work, but it works because you lose weight. But there are problems with the body fighting you. If you've already got elevated insulin, the body's going to fight you, and you may end up losing muscle mass, which will further aggravate the problem. Now, if you have borderline glucose or elevated insulin, there are insulin sensitizers that are effective. Alpha-lipoic acid is good. About a quarter teaspoon of cinnamon is good. Chromium, usually you want to go for, or at the most, 500 micrograms of chromium. And one of my favorites, berberine. And berberine also is very helpful for fixing your microbiome and lowering your cholesterol. Doses of this 500 milligrams three times a day. And these help normalize the body's insulin response and thus lower body's insulin. Another thing to watch out for dietarily if you have fibroids is dairy. And that's because of the bovine growth hormone that's added to non-organic dairy. And remember, dairy is a food that was intended for the young. It's intended to be a very high-energy food, and it does contain growth factors. So there are some links between prostate cancer and breast cancer and high dairy consumption. And I'm really not sure that just being super clean and super organic and grass-fed and, you know, happy, contented cows is enough there. I think it's better to avoid and go to a nut milk or a grain milk like a hemp milk. And the other last thing is the crucifers, all right? Your body needs that to get that estrogen down. So regardless of what other risk factors you have, you got to make sure you poop because you're pooping out the estrogen. You got to fix your microbiome because if you don't have a good microbiome, you will have bacteria in there that make an enzyme that actually actively interferes and torpedoes the elimination process. And the estrogen, which has been, let's say, locked into a molecule that's going to act as a carrier molecule and keep it in the poop. Once you unlock that, the estrogen runs away like you just released its leg iron, immediately absorbs back into the bloodstream and heads for that fibroid again, and then again stimulates further fibroid growth. So it's extremely important to recognize that lifestyle and diet and behavior are all things that make a huge difference in the health of your body. And if you have a family history of fibroids running in your family, you probably want to take a good, hard, long look at that butt-to-gut ratio, get your weight under control, and shift your diet away from dairy and in the direction of the crucifers. low hormone foods. My producer wants me to mention that there are hormones in meat that can also torpedo the process. And again, we're talking about a high fruit and vegetable diet. So maybe go like the Chinese do and consider meat a condiment, not the star of the dish, but merely a supporting actor. And reducing the meat, of course, has benefits for the environment. And so both the internal environment and the external environment might be just a little bit happier. We've got a quick story. I think I'm going to roll with it. I think we have time for both of these if I'm quick. There's a new organ on the block, and it's in your skin. It's been called the nociceptive neuroglial complex. Glial cells, where are they? Well, we find them in the brain, and they're a type of cell that isn't really a nerve cell, but it likes to hang out with nerve cells. And it's a mesh of cells that acts kind of as the cleanup crew and the immune system of nerve cells. They form a little net between the skin's inner and outer layers, and they have these filament-like protrusions that extend up, and it turns out that they play a key role in the perception of pain caused by pressure, pricking, and impacts on the skin. There's a condition called allodynia, where the skin becomes so sensitive that even a very light touch or a brush can be excruciating. This is probably due to a disease or an inflammation of the glial cells. Because they hang out with nerves, they may be associated with neuropathic pain. This is an interesting discovery because it shows that we don't know nearly as much as we think we know. And so is the next story. The author titled it Zombie Genes. And it turns out, even hours after we die, certain cells in the human brain are still active. Well, okay. But some cells even increase their activity and grow in the dead brain. This is a real surprise. It was just published in Scientific Report. The researcher who did it had a privileged position. I'll get to that in a minute. But researchers analyzed gene expression in fresh brain tissue, which was collected during routine brain surgery, and they checked it multiple times after removal to kind of simulate what happens after death. And they found that gene expression in some cells actually increased after death. And these were our friends, the glial cells. Glial cells actually grow and sprout long arm-like appendages, which is what they do. And they do it for many hours after a person dies. Now, these cells are inflammatory in the brain, and their job is to clean things up after brain injuries, like oxygen deprivation or stroke. But it has interesting implications, because a lot of our brain research uses post-mortem human brain tissues that are not being evaluated immediately. And we'd use these to find treatments for things like autism. Nope, not very good. Don't have many treatments. Schizophrenia, debatable. And Alzheimer's disease, forget it. Is this one of the reasons why the drugs we keep developing don't seem to work? The chief researcher here is Dr. Jeffrey Loeb, and he noted that when they were looking at gene expression in their fresh human brain tissue, it didn't match any of the published reports of brain gene expression in those people with neurologic disorders. So he said, well, maybe it's too late. Maybe it's, the brain's gone off. They simulated death by looking at the expression from 0 to 24 hours in room temperature brain to kind of simulate what happens after death. This was brain tissue that was collected for surgery. And normally those things would be just looked at, analyzed, and discarded, but, you know, donated to science. And lo and behold, most of the genes, 80%, remained stable for 24 hours. These genes kept expressing in the glial cells. And the ones that were present in neurons, so basically the brain tissue that's thinking, those degenerated rapidly after death. But the zombie genes actually increased their activity just as the neurons were ramping down, and they peaked 12 hours after death. So what it says is we need to rethink our research, we need to rethink our science, we need to go back and ask ourselves a question. Can we believe our conclusions, or do we need to repeat the studies looking at those gene expression studies in fresh brain specimens trying to figure out what's going on? I love these
everything you think you know is wrong stories, because all knowledge, as I think all of us have seen in science over the last couple of, certainly over the last year, what we know is provisional, subject to change without notice as new data emerges. And it's not definitive. Almost nothing is. And once you realize that you're skiing on a moving plane where things can crop up that you don't expect, it changes your approach to the data. This is Dr. Dawn. I hope you've enjoyed this program. I want to wish you a great week. I'll be back next week. For now, so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.